Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for coming to the Transportation Finance and Policy Division for our meeting here on Tuesday, the 29th. We have a couple of agenda items today. We'll start off with a presentation from the American Society of Civil Engineers about the state of our infrastructure, which I think will be very compelling and important for this committee to hear. And then we have an overview hearing from the Department of Public Safety that will follow that, approximately 1:15, 1:20. The commissioner will be here, as well as some other senior staff members. And then on Thursday, we'll have the last members, the last of our overview hearings, at least for now, with the Metropolitan Airports Commission, some additional information on Greater Minnesota Transit and the aviation program at MnDOT. So that's our roadmap for the rest of the week. And at the end of the hearing, I'll give you a preview of what we plan to do next week. So we don't have a quorum. As soon as that happens, Representative Petersburg, I'll call on you for the minutes. And at this point, I would like to call on representatives from the American Society of Civil Engineers. Members, I was intrigued and concerned, disturbed, if you will, about a report that this organization released late last year. It's actually a report card about the state of Minnesota's infrastructure, and I thought that it would be helpful to hear from this organization, which is nonpartisan. They're engineers. You can't get any more nonpartisan than engineers. So I thought that they could give us a pretty objective and informed, clear-eyed perspective on the state of our infrastructure in Minnesota. So with that, I hand over the hearing to you, and please introduce yourself, state your name for the record, and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Seth Spihala, and I am a civil engineer. I am the legislative committee chair for the Minnesota section of the American Society of Civil Engineers. My colleagues and I are pleased to present to the committee the findings of the transportation categories of the 2018 infrastructure card for Minnesota's infrastructure. The American Society of Civil Engineers represents more than 150,000 members of the civil engineering profession across the world. ASCE was founded in 1852 and is the oldest engineering society in the country. ASCE is a nonprofit organization. The Minnesota section of ASCE is made up of more than 1,700 men and women, volunteers in the engineering profession. Our section celebrated its centennial in 2014. Our members are the designers, constructors, maintainers, and operators of Minnesota's infrastructure, the backbone of our society, the built environment. The first ASCE National Infrastructure Report Card was released in 1998. You may have heard the report referenced in the President of the United States' State of the Union addresses. The Society releases a national report card every 4 years. In 2017, ASCE gave the nation's overall infrastructure a grade of D+. We started researching and planning for the Minnesota report card back in 2016. Jason Stabell is the report card's committee chair. We have 9 lead authors, and we had 9 additional supporting members. All of us are volunteers. We released the findings of the report card in October of 2018, 18 months after we started. The 2018 Minnesota Infrastructure Report Card gives the state infrastructure a cumulative GPA grade of C. You've all been given a pamphlet with the report card's executive summary, and you can see that a grade of C is mediocre and requires attention. The grades of each of the categories are based on 8 criteria: capacity, condition, funding, future need, operation and maintenance, public safety, resilience, and innovation. The 9 individual categories graded are also included in the pamphlet. The highest grade was a B for aviation, and the lowest grade was a D-plus for roads. The full 82-page report can be found at www.infrastructurereportcard.org/Minnesota. The URL address is also included in the pamphlet. And with that, I will turn it over to my colleague, Nick Turner, who will discuss roads.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, thank you for the opportunity to testify before your committee. My name is Nick Turner, and I am a licensed professional civil engineer whose career is focused on transportation design. I was the lead author for the roadway section. My mission this afternoon is to fluently communicate the findings of the Minnesota State Report Card on Infrastructure as it pertains to the roadways in Minnesota. The American Society of Civil Engineers Minnesota chapter assigned a letter grade of D-plus to the roads in Minnesota. That is a poor grade and depicts that the roads of Minnesota require immediate attention. So first, the amount of roads we have. Minnesota has nearly 140,000 miles of roadway. This is not the measurement of lane miles. This is the number of center lane miles, actual miles of pavement in Minnesota. This puts Minnesota with the 5th most miles of roadway in the United States. 140,000 miles is more than 50 trips from Los Angeles to New York, all packed into our one state. Of these miles, 16% are considered urban, leaving around 116,000 miles of rural roads in Minnesota. I wanted to break this down because of the safety difference noticed between urban and rural roads. On the 16% that are urban, Minnesota has a fatality rate of 0.29 deaths per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. On the rural roads, there is nearly a 4 times increase, up to a 1.12 deaths per 100 million vehicle miles. When combined, the whole state as a whole is at 0.63 fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles, which is better than the national average of 1.16, but it still means that in 2017, 358 deaths occurred on Minnesota roads. The condition of the roads. Of the 140,000 miles, 12,000 miles make up the state-owned trunk highway system. Currently, the Minnesota trunk highway system meets each of MnDOT's targets for a percentage of poor roadways. I chose to show the poor rating as part of my report because any road which falls far enough to be labeled poor will require a full reconstruction to get any meaningful life back out of that roadway pavement section. MnDOT's 10-year projection shows these favorable conditions disappearing. These 10-year projections show nearly 5 times more interstate miles will be poor. Nearly 4 times more other national highway system miles will be poor, and more than 2 times non-national highway system miles will be poor. In 10 years, we are expected to not meet MnDOT's target for interstate or other national highway system miles in regards to the number of miles that are in poor condition here in the state of Minnesota. Congestion of the roads. When reviewing congestion levels in Minnesota, we not only found that the Twin Cities area has some of the worst congestion in the state, but that this area is recognized nationally for its congestion. With an average driver losing 41 hours in traffic each year, it is anticipated that congestion costs Minnesotans more than $2.3 billion each year. That makes the Twin Cities the 17th worst urban area in the United States in regards to lost compensation due to congestion. We also found that the trucking industry has a separate measure of congestion in regards to truck travel through urban areas. Again, the Twin Cities appeared near the top of the list. The trucking industry identified 5 intersections in the Twin Cities, all which fall into the worst 100 bottlenecks in the United States. The only urban areas to have more than the Twin Cities are Houston and Atlanta. Next is the cost of roads. Every 4 years, MnDOT updates their 20-year Minnesota State Highway Investment Plan, the MnSHIP plan. Most recently, this report was released in January of 2017. The 2017 report showed that the projected investment over the next 20 years will fall $17.7 billion short of the investment need. That leaves an $885 million funding gap in that 20-year plan. In 2013, the last time that report was produced, the annual funding gap was identified as $695 million. The gap grew $190 million over those 4 years. If that same growth shows up again in the 2021 report, the annual funding gap could be measured in billions annually rather than millions. Maintenance of our roads. Roadway costs in our state are not solely about repairing and replacing the pavement. Keeping the roads clear and safe is also a priority. Maintenance crews work all winter to keep roads clear of ice and snow, and they work all summer to keep them clear of debris after major storms and accidents. These maintenance costs are also seeing a rise in prices. Salt prices alone have more than doubled since 2001. Maintenance crew demand has also increased. In 2010, cable median barriers in Minnesota averaged 5 hits per mile annually, being repaired and maintained by our maintenance crews. Raising the grades for our roads. Innovative ideas for pavement management plans are available, but the lack of known funding causes concerns by many of the owners. If owners were more comfortable that available funds would be available when needed, many pavement life cycles could be extended through planned maintenance. But in our climate, with the winters and the summers being so different, missing these pavement milestones by 1 or 2 years could cost much more than the original pavement management plan called for. One-time funding is very much appreciated, but relying on it reduces the number of tools we as engineers have in our toolbox. Being able to plan ahead could help us keep pavements in the good condition range for much longer than we currently see. That is why we need to solidify an increased dedicated funding source for our roadways in Minnesota.
Question from Representative Petersburg. Thank you very much.
Before you step down, I do have a question just on, thank you, Mr. Chair, for that. If I could get just a clarifying question. I'm trying to figure out the mathematics here. In talking about the average driver spends 41 peak hours in a congestion each year, and I don't discount that that's true. I just don't understand how the peak hours are determined, because if I figure that out, that's less than 1 hour per week, 10 trips a week. It's really pretty small in regards to the amount of congestion. And then when you add $1,332 per driver, that's $35 an peak hour. So am I just not understanding that properly, or how do you calculate those?
Mr. Turner?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Those hours are calculated, actually, though, by the number of drivers in the state. So to think about some of the time lost in the Twin Cities alone in congestion or some of the other areas, think about the number of drivers across the state as well. Okay. There are some drivers who deal with no congestion that are pulling that average or helping that average out.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Representative Petersburg.
Okay, thank you. That could explain why it goes down if you do it across the state. But then where do we get the $1,332 for those 41 peak hours?
Mr. Chairman, I cannot provide the exact answer to that right now. I would have to come back with further clarification. Right.
Well, I would encourage maybe, Mr. Turner, that you could be in touch with not only represent Petersburg, but maybe copy the committee on that.
We'll definitely do that.
Important question. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Olson. I'm a licensed professional engineer with over 30 years of bridge engineering experience. I'm also a past president of the Minnesota Section of Civil Engineers. My task this afternoon is to articulate the condition of our bridges and the funding needs for public bridges in Minnesota. The bridge event locked into most Minnesotans' minds is the 35W collapse 11 years ago. There are nearly 20,000 bridges in Minnesota, and about 5.4% of them are structurally deficient or in poor condition. The civil engineers have given bridges a grade of a C, and this is much better than the roads, and in part it reflects the investment you've made with the Chapter 152 program. You're one behind. Let's go. One more.
All right. Sorry.
A lot of funding numbers are tied to bridge deck area. It's simply the length of a bridge multiplied by its width. And if we add up all the bridge deck area in Minnesota, we get to about 88 million square feet of deck area. And that really doesn't mean much to people. If you had 3.1 square miles, that might mean a little bit more. But if you think about it in U.S. Bank stadiums, it's more than 50 U.S. Bank stadiums scattered around the state that are more than 30 years old. So they're not brand new, shiny stadiums. They're 30-year-old stadiums on average. As part of our investigation, we looked at three systems. We looked at the state highway system, the local highway system, and we also looked at park trails and bridges, or parks and trails, as a third system. About one quarter of the bridges in Minnesota are on the state highway system, three quarters are on the local system, and there are hundreds and hundreds of bridges on the trail system. We did not look at skyways, we did not look at railroad bridges, which are private bridges. On the state system, as you've been told by others before me, the interstate era bridges are coming to the end of their service life. It's estimated that about 80 of these bridges are reaching the end of their service life every year. An average cost is approximately $2 million apiece for a need of $160 million a year. And these projects range from more modest structures to much bigger ones. On the left, you see the St. Croix crossing. On the right, you see some of the interchanges that are coming to age, I guess. This 494 and 35W in the picture, its condition is deteriorating, and it will need to be upgraded due to congestion. It should be noted that this $160 million is less than the $200 million per year provided as part of the Chapter 152 program. Moving on to the local bridge system, there are a wide variety of needs on the local bridge system. There are large structures such as the 10th Avenue Bridge in Minneapolis to much more modest structures. On the right you see a little arch bridge in Wilkin County where they've had to make do with some unique embankment treatments there, if you will. There are about nearly $500 million worth of local bridge projects identified by the state aid office that could be worked on right now. Moving on to parks and trails. On the left, you see a bridge up in Black Duck, Minnesota, that has been abandoned for a few years after an arson event. And on the right, you see the Jay Cook Bridge that was damaged as part of the flooding a few years ago. The DNR has about 500 bridges on their system. More than 400 of those are non-vehicular bridges, and there's no dedicated funding source for this roster of bridges. The message here is that there are far more trail bridges than most people realize, and they often get only the scraps of funding after other needs are taken care of. So to revisit the funding needs and anticipated funding levels. So this was put together last spring, 2000, 18, and so some of the numbers are a little bit dated. The state-owned system, the needs are $160 million a year. It's anticipated there's roughly $100 million available per year going forward, leaving a shortfall of $60 million per year. On the local system, the needs are about $100 million per year. $60 million is typically provided. Last year, things fell far short of that, and the funding was about $13 million. On the parks and trails system, we anticipate that needs are on the order of $10 million per year for those bridges. On the right is a graphic. It simply says that vehicular bridges in Minnesota, there are about 1,400 that would qualify for repair monies or replacement monies from the feds. So with 1,400 bridges eligible for work, it was hard to give a grade higher than a C. How can we raise the grade? A reliable, consistent funding stream is desirable. One-time funding is very much appreciated, but it does make it difficult to manage, as Nick mentioned. Often owners are left to be in this feast or famine funding cycle where there's an allotment of money, they take care of it, and then needs build up over time. And so there really isn't a lot of opportunity sometimes to do regular medium-sized projects. Often it's maintenance projects such as overlays, and then it goes to replacement. And it would be probably a better investment to spend some more dollars on those rehabilitation projects. So,
Mr. Olson, I just have a question for you.
Sure.
One of the statistics that you mentioned at the beginning that jumped out at me was a 5.4% structurally deficient bridge. Can you define, perhaps even in lay terms, what that means? What is the criteria for a bridge to be classified as structurally deficient?
So structurally, there are inspector ranking systems, if you will. And one of the typical ranking systems is the national system that goes from a score of a 0 to a completely failed component to a 9, which is a brand new component. And one of those codes for the bridge deck, the bridge superstructure, or the substructure falls to a level where it hits a 4, which is basically the equivalent of a poor condition. It trips the trigger to become structurally deficient.
So these are in poor condition, but yet still remain open?
Yes.
Okay. And then what needs to happen for a bridge to go from poor to then having a regulatory agency close it or reroute traffic or something like that?
So if I understand your question, is what below a 4, what happens?
Exactly.
And so I think my understanding is that primarily the planning effort would take place when things hit a 5. And the rule of thumb generally is that those 0 to 9 categories, you drop one category per year, if you will. From a 5 to a 4 is a 10-year period. From a 4 to a 3 is another 10-year period. It depends on the bridge in particular, but that's a rule of thumb. So as the bridge gets into a poor condition from a 4, you probably have a reduced load capacity, and you would start posting the bridge and reducing the amount of traffic that could cross it.
Thank you. So we have one last engineer, I think, for us. Mr. Yassis.
Good afternoon,
welcome
Mr.
to
Chair.
The committee. Please state your name and for the record.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Darwin Yassis, and I'm the chairperson for the transit section of the ASC report card. And I'm a licensed professional engineer here in Minnesota. So now we're going to be talking about transit in Minnesota. But before I move on, basically I just wanted to express to the group regarding Minnesota, when I first moved here, population continued to grow. It was very metropolitan these days. Before that, I think there's a transition period that's happening. So right now, Minnesota has 5.7 population. 3.6 is within the Twin Cities metro area, and the remainder is within the outstate districts. Other metro regions are also growing, namely Duluth area, for example, St. Cloud, Rochester, and Mankato, to name a few. Those areas are all being serviced by our public transit system, and annually we have served 111 million rides in Minnesota with our public transit systems. 99 million of those rides are happening within the metro area, and the remainder, 12 million, is in the greater Minnesota area. Transit systems, there are about 43 transit systems in greater Minnesota and 7 in the metro area. In the metro area, I think Metro Transit, for instance, basically represents about 81% of the ridership statewide. When we first started looking at the public transit systems, we were able to identify $450 million needed over the next 5 years to be able to keep up with this growing population and at the same time a growing need. And I think as I move forward, we'd be able to show you this growing need. And what that translates to would be $5 billion within the next 20 years. Apparently, the current funding level is not sufficient to be able to keep them in good standing. Again, this slide is just showing the breakdown of the ridership in Minnesota. 111 million total. Again, if you see on your screen, predominantly the Metro Met Council services pretty much dominate the ridership. Before I move on with the budget numbers, I think it's also good to point out that there's a steady increase in ridership within the last 15 years, about 1.6 in average. But at the same time, if you translate it, we basically have experienced the fourth largest growth rate within 2005 to 2015 compared to our peer cities. Comparable cities would be Seattle, Portland, Baltimore, for example, some of our peer cities. In 2015, in fact, going back to the number of rides, we recorded a high of 12.2 million rides, which was actually a record number. And associated with that one, it garnered 1.24 million hours of service to come up with that. So now, when we started looking at the operating costs, we started looking at Greater Minnesota and what's happening within the metro area. So this figure is just a basic breakdown. I'm aware that you guys are all aware about the funding sources. So this is just a dissection and representation of the different funding sources for our transit system. So 89 million within the greater Minnesota area, and then within the Metro Twin Cities area, we're looking at about $511 million. Again, in terms of growth rate, we've seen quite a lot of growth happening. So it's not only in the Twin Cities, but also collectively within the greater outstate districts. And this table just shows you the progression of those demands developing and changes that happened within the last 10 years. In our first slide, we mentioned that there's about $5 billion worth of investment gap. And through our research, one thing to point out would be the condition rating for all these massive infrastructure systems within Minnesota. There's no currently a formal rating condition system available. And so what we looked at is basically the workhorse of the public transit system, which is the vehicle fleet. So today there are about 3,300 vehicle fleets in Minnesota. most of those vehicle fleets actually average years is 5.6, and a little bit better than national average, which is 7.4. But one thing to point out is that vehicle transit useful life is a combination of years of service and the number of miles performed. And in 2016, 22% of these vehicle fleets were actually past their useful life. So what we mean by useful life is the ability to be able to provide reliable service to address those needs. And at the same time, in 2016, we also found out that the spare ratio is 16.4, which basically falls below the standard spare ratio of 20%. I think that's basically capping up the transit section. And to be able to raise the grade, again, I think the findings is that we need to be able to find a sustainable funding source for our public transit system, adequately fund them, especially the maintenance portion, because the ridership are growing. It may sound rosy or it may seem rosy in front, but at the same time, the operational needs is going to be heavily dependent on those midlife cycle costs needed.
Thank you, Mr. Yasas. We have a question from Vice Chair Tapke, and then Representative Mason after that, and then Representative Runbeck, and then we'll wrap up. And Representative Hausman, and then by 1:25 we really need to wrap up, although I'm glad we have these questions, but we have another presentation. Vice Chair Tapke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for your presentation. I've got a couple questions on the intersection of roads and bridges and transit from your perspectives as an engineer. So it's been my experience that I'm down in Shakopee, and there was a big project that was done at 169 and 484 that really did a major expansion to that interchange, and it was a fantastic project that got done, but it just moved the congestion and bottlenecks to other areas. How does transit and that mitigation of congestion, how do those things interlink, and how can we as a system make that work better? Because I think that transit is very dependent on roadways being successful, and roadways being successful is very dependent on transit. So how do we make that all work within our system and not spend hundreds of billions of dollars to just move congestion around to other places?
Mr. Chairperson?
That's a road and transit question, but I guess we'll have Mr. Yasas take that.
Well, actually, the answer is, especially MnDOT has actually developed different performance criteria. So now instead of a level service, say, for example, level service of highway is dependent on the number of vehicles going through a particular system. Now I think the system metrics is being redefined by identifying the number of occupants going through a particular segment. So you are exactly correct that they need to be hand in hand, and that's what's happening right now. It's a combination of roadway infrastructure together with transit facilities.
Okay, quick follow-up from the Vice Chair.
So what do you suggest that where do you suggest we put our investments in order to make sure that we're successful into the future?
We've identified several strategies. In fact, we've identified several innovations that Minnesota is already doing. For example, bus-only shoulders. We have over 300 miles of bus-only shoulders throughout our system, which definitely facilitates the transit advantage without having a fixed guideway. So it answers those in-between needs, between the highway need and the transit need.
Thank you.
Here we have Representative Mason, Hausman, and Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've heard the terms dedicated funding, sustainable funding, and some of us that have been around know why this is really important. But if you would, again, take the time to explain why sustainable funding, dedicated funding is so important for us in the future.
Mr. Yasas.
So right now, I think within the ASE report card, there's also a common theme that dedicated funding needs to be identified. We've seen the life cycle of all these assets, so whether it's roadway, bridges, or transit. And what we commonly see is that it's being taken for granted. So we're putting high emphasis in terms of being able to maintain our current infrastructure, and also the ability to enhance those infrastructure to facilitate future demands.
Thank you.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ever since the MnDOT presentation, which echoed some of these same statistics, I've been troubled by that statistic that Minnesota has the fifth highest number of public roadways, and I'm sort of not proud of that. I mean, I think we did something wrong when we built such a big system. When you look at the geography of our state, we shouldn't have the fifth highest number of public roadways. And the interesting thing is, he also cites we have some of the worst congestion in the country, so clearly building lots of roads hasn't led to an uncongested system. And what I remember is there was a phrase, I think it's called induced demand or something, where you build a road, you widen it, and it just attracts more traffic, and so you haven't really accomplished anything. And the real accomplishment is if we had more aggressively been building up our public mass transit system, which would provide an alternative to that congestion, which we haven't done. And I don't know, as you've done your comparisons of states, do you track them where they take your information and what they do with the policy and funding as these two relate?
Mr. Yassas?
So, Mr. Chairperson, when we started looking at the comparables from peer cities and what other states have done, basically the first question that came to our mind is, what's the critical mass? Because obviously there needs to be density to be able to make public transportation systems feasible. And when we started looking at New York, for example, in the 1900s, they started when they have 1 million in population. All the other areas also followed suit, somewhere in the range of 2.5 million. And now we're in the 3.5 million only in the Twin Cities. So I think it's good to point out that it's ripe enough. That's why we're seeing big demands for our transit system. That's why, for instance, the Green Line, when it opened, it already exceeded the 15-year projection on the first and second years of operation.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, where does passenger rail fit? Did you study that in relation? Does that fit under transit, or where would we find the outcomes of passenger rail, intercity?
Those are some background information. In fact, some of the Metropolitan Council regional studies identify some of those peer cities.
So, well, Representative Runbeck will have the last question. I'll make a couple of quick comments, and then we'll have the Department of Public Safety. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sir, listening to your transit information, does your organization look at, the benchmark of how many trips are on transit, what percent of trips, rather, are on transit versus all trips? I know that we like to look at the millions of trips, right, total, but that isn't the total picture. So I think it's helpful for folks who are new to this committee. I think we like transit. We know we need transit, but even as such, it's about 5% of total trips in the Twin Cities Metro. Isn't that about right?
Mr. Yassas?
Mr. Chairperson, I think the 5%, I won't be able to verify that at this moment. So we can look at that for.
Thank you.
Okay. And I just wanted the committee to know, thank you, all of you, for your presentation. And what I would like to request of you is, the PowerPoint was excellent, and if it's possible for you to send it to the members of the committee or directly to Mr. Howe, and then he can send it on, I think that would be very helpful to us. And I wanted the committee to know, Michael Menora was going to come and talk about aviation. He's unable to, but we're going to have a whole day of aviation on Thursday. We're going to have the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and we're also going to have MnDOT talking about their aviation program. So if you have questions about airports, and weren't able to ask them today, we'll have an opportunity on Thursday. So thank you for that. Before we transition to the Department of Public Safety's overview, we do now have a quorum. And I'm wondering, Representative Petersburg, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do, and thank you for requesting the PowerPoint, because I was going to ask for that, yeah, too. I approve the January 24th minutes of the Transportation Committee.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion to approve the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Petersburg. We have one final overview for today, and that is the Department of Public Safety members, particularly those who are new. We have, of course, airports, passenger rail, public transit, roads and bridges, but there is a purview of this committee also involving the Department of Public Safety, particularly, as we'll hear today, driver and vehicle services, pipeline safety, several of the state patrol. These are all under our purview. Of course, other aspects of the Department of Public Safety, most of them, of course, are under the purview of the Committee on Public Safety. But we have a sizable share of their involvement. And I know that one thing that's on people's minds is the MnLARS program. We'll hear a little about that today. But, members, I wanted to let you know that after the legislative auditor's report comes out in the middle of the month, I believe, middle of February, we'll have a more in-depth conversation about MnLARS. And we have a few bills, I think, that have been referred to our committee related to MnLARS. And we'll hear a few of those even as early as next week. So I just wanted to let the committee know about those. And this is actually a nice opportunity to remind the committee that as our bills start piling up, we'll try to hear them. And please get your hearing requests in, and we'll try to get in as many of these as possible. And then we'll also have a final, probably in the next couple of days, a final schedule of our field hearings. So with that, Commissioner, welcome. We have Commissioner Harrington, and, you know, we can call you Senator, we can call you Chief, but for now, Commissioner, and congratulations on your appointment. I know we're all excited for you and looking forward to working with you. Welcome to the committee.
Representative Hornstein, members of the committee, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to meet with you today. It is an exciting time, obviously. As you can guess, I'm starting week four now. So, and as many of my colleagues have noted, that I can't hold a job, so I just keep rolling through. But eventually, we're going to figure out what I'm good at, and I'm hoping that I'm good at this. So I really do want to be able to serve your committee and serve the people of Minnesota in the broadest sense of the word. So, the Department of Public Safety is a much bigger department than I had any reason to know about when I got there. Frankly, I could have named about five of the different divisions of the department when I got the call from the governor's office. I was shocked to find out that there were 14 different divisions there. There are well in excess of 2,000 individuals, and the majority of the individuals that work for the Department of Public Safety actually report through the Transportation Commission, Transportation Committee, with DVS and the state troopers having well over 1,000 of the 2,000 people that work for DPS. The mission of the Department of Public Safety is to keep Minnesota safe, and that really is a very broad mandate. It is a mandate that speaks to everything from the roadways of Minnesota and keeping people from driving in an imprudent fashion or an illegal fashion, to pipeline safety, to alcohol and gambling, to working with victims of crime. But I will tell you that my mission, my personal vision for the department, is one that I've had in the past, which is to bring to this department a vision and an ethic that says that we will be first and foremost responsive to the communities we serve. And that, for me, means first and foremost listening. And so I'm looking forward to meeting with you individually and collectively to hear what your vision of safety for the state of Minnesota is, so that I can exercise that vision. Secondarily, and not any less important, though, I really also believe that the department that is most effective is the department that's most reflective of the community we serve. And so my past background has led me to increased diversity in terms of languages, in terms of race, ethnicity, and in terms of gender. And I hope to be able to bring that kind of value system to the Department of Public Safety. As I mentioned, the department's a big department. It's over 2,100 employees, and we operate programs. Emergency management, which we've been talking about the last few days as the cold has hit Minnesota, and talked about what should we do, how can we preload that. And I'm quite pleased to tell you that one of my first experiences with Matt Langer, the colonel of the State Patrol, was to ask the question, well, with with all the accidents we expected we're going to have, do we have extra troopers on the road? And he said he had already pre-programmed extra troopers. He had a relief valve. He had a surge already set up. And if the accidents had risen to a certain rate, we were ready to go. We did not need that. But good planning is part and parcel of how this department will run. Traffic safety is another component of this, and that really speaks to the educational mission of the department, educating people about what is good traffic safety, but also educating them about things like texting and the dangers of that and how we can help avoid the collisions that come directly as a result of that. We work in partnership with both local governments and nonprofits to try and make sure that Minnesotans, no matter where they are in the state, have a safe experience, and we help prevent crimes as much as we take action to enforce the laws against them. I think that is one of the most important things we can do, and I also think it's incredibly important that this department is the department that focuses on victims of crime. Through Author of Justice programs, we are also the group that talks to, I'm wearing my purple ribbon today because we're going to go and read the names of women who've been killed as part of the femicide report. We're the department that responds to sexual assault victims. We're the department that also does crime victims reparations. So it is a big mandate, and we have big goals that we have set up. I'm happy to have my number two, the Deputy Commissioner Sandra O'Hearn, come today. She's going to give you a more detailed breakdown of the divisions that are within the Transportation Committee. But I certainly would stand ready for questions if there are any.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner Harrington. And we do have one so far from Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually was on the list so that I didn't get missed this time. So I can wait until we get through the presentation and then ask my question. I can ask now.
I mean, we're fine.
Okay, that's fine.
Ask now.
Sure. So on it's in the PowerPoint that I'm leading up to and that they're going to be talking about. And I'll ask now, I guess. So the points that I don't see on here, and I've noticed this before, is bicycle and pedestrian safety. And when I think of pedestrian safety, I think our ultimate pedestrians on our roadways actually are in our work zones. There are the workers of our state that are working on our roads. And I don't see any mention of that, and I'm wondering, I would love to have that expanded in the Department of Public Safety to be a part of their vision and mission, because I know in the state of Minnesota, it's growing the number of injuries that are happening in our work zones, and those are our loved ones and, you know, our neighbors. So that is my question. And
Representative Bernardi, Representative Hornstein, and I will have to admit that I do not know whether there is a bicycle safety part of. I would expect that there would be some in the traffic safety section, but I will, in fact, research that, and I will get you an answer as to what our role is in that. I know in my previous roles, we had a lot of work with the local jurisdictions because the predominant use of bicycles were on local public streets, not so much on public highways. But let me get some more information, and I will get back to you on that. And I'd be happy to have a more full discussion about what the state's role is in making sure that those who are both working in work zones for the Department of Transportation and others, and also those who are using two-wheel, non-motorized conveyances are also. We do want to make sure that they are also safe as they come into contact with the general traveling public.
And thank you, Mr. Just a follow-up.
And
pedestrians.
Pedestrians. I also noted both of those, both the workers, pedestrians, and the bicycles.
Yes, thank you.
Representative Corkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Commissioner Harrington. The last time I saw you at a testifier stand, you were still the chief of the Metro Transit Police, and we were talking about fare collection on the light rail system. And I have a lot of confidence in the commissioner because it was some weeks before I rode the light rail again, but the very next time I got on the light rail train, two of your officers were there to check my ticket. I don't know how you accomplished that, but if you can do that, you can do anything.
Representative Coles, thank you very much for that vote of confidence, and I promise you that we will be as responsive to your concerns we had on fare collections as the concerns here that are voiced in transportation.
Are there any additional questions for the commissioner? Well, again, I personally want to congratulate you, welcome you, and you know, appreciate your service, whether it was as the chief of Metro Transit Police, but also as a state senator. We have three former colleagues now as commissioners that our committee has purview over. So, you know, I think your legislative experience, I think, will come in handy, and we appreciate that so much.
Thank you very much.
So, with that, members, we'll transition to the rest of our overview. I assume Deputy Commissioner will take it from here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Cassandra O'Hearn. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. Chair and members of the committee, if I may, the screen that you should have visible is a brief overview. And Commissioner Harrington has already mentioned, but as you are aware, the Department of Public Safety has two different committees for budget purposes, and we'll be talking today. Can you see the? Hopefully not. Sorry about that. Talking today about specifically the divisions that fall under the Transportation Committee. That will be the State Patrol, the Office of Traffic Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, Office of Pipeline Safety. We also have our administrative and related services, and we'll save that for budget conversations. We do have the division directors available, and so as we move through, if there are specific questions, I would like to call them up, introduce them, and then they can answer anything that's more in-depth than what I'm able to do. Very briefly, and I'm not going to go through this slide, you have a copy of it, but it gives you a brief understanding of how the Department of Public Safety came together, how the various divisions were created at different times. For instance, the position of State Fire Marshal first created in 1905. The department was created in 1969 to serve as that administrative body. And brought amongst it many of the already existing agencies at that time. And then others were added. And one of our most recent ones, the Office of Traffic Safety, in 2004, is here today. Put some context, when the department was created in 1969, there is a picture of what the troopers were driving. They're a little bit different than they are today. They do still have the white doors, however. So the State Patrol is one of our most visible divisions, and of course that's because whenever you see them, they're in uniform and their cars, so you're able to spot them. Their mission is to protect and serve all people in the state, and they do that in a variety of different ways, through assistance, education, and enforcement, and all of those are equally important. They provide support to allied agencies. Those are other law enforcement partners as well as non-law enforcement partners in the area of traffic safety to provide for the safe and efficient movement of traffic on Minnesota roadways. And I hope they're staying warm today and helping any stranded motorists. So the department is, State Patrol has a variety in its large mission of different units and program areas, from aviation, capital security, executive protection. They have canines. They, of course, do crash reconstruction. And I'm not going to read these all. You can see them and you have them. But they provide a variety of different areas. In doing their mission, they have over 18 million miles that were traveled in 2018. Their jobs are to often is to be in the cars and patrolling those roadways throughout all of Minnesota. They have done almost 400 traffic stops in 2018 and made 450,000 enforcement contacts. Those would be citations and warnings. Those are often opportunities to provide education in order to change people's behavior. They have investigated 29,000 crashes. They have removed over 5,900 impaired drivers from Minnesota roadways and inspected 17,500 school buses to ensure that students are being transported in safe vehicles. And they have also provided over 1,300 traffic safety presentations, often to community organizations or school groups. The State Patrol includes over almost 900 full-time sworn and non-sworn personnel. Here we provide some information about how their annual appropriation on their budget, which includes mainly from the Trunk Highway Fund, some from the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund for vehicle crimes, and general fund dollars, which are predominantly for capital security purposes. They also receive federal dollars as well. At this time, I would like to, with the chair's approval, invite Colonel Matt Langer to introduce him and answer any particular questions about the State Patrol.
Good to see you. Welcome to the committee, Colonel Langer.
Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Matt Langer. I have the honor and privilege of serving as the chief of the Minnesota State Patrol, and I stand for any questions you might have.
Members? Yes. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Colonel Langer, welcome back to the committee. Couple of things for you. This is my first term on the Transportation Committee in the House, but it's been a passion of mine, and I also understand that this committee has purview over your budget because of the sales tax dollars or the gas tax dollars, and that's where your budget is dedicated. And I guess I have some concerns as I've been visiting with troopers in my area and have been visiting with others in law enforcement, and we're seeing a general move away from people wanting to get into law enforcement for various different reasons. And I'm very concerned about how you're going to be able to continue to staff adequately the department that you oversee here in the state of Minnesota for public safety. I was quickly reminded by my father, who was in law enforcement, that you're called state troopers and not the state patrol because you come off the highway and you aid other agencies, which at the time the agency that my father headed up was a very small agency in the city of Sartell. It's since grown to a larger organization when he was the chief, and that's something that just resonates. And a side note, I recognize that 1969 vehicle that was in there because it used to be parked in front of our house quite regularly when I was growing up as well. So I guess I have some follow-up questions, and I guess I would toss that to you, Colonel, for your views on that. And again, I do have some follow-up questions as well. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
Thank you for that, Representative O'Driscoll. Colonel Langer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, those are great points. We appreciate the support. So there's about 615 troopers, which seems like a lot, but when you spread them across 87 counties, it gets thin in some areas, depending on where you work. Obviously, a lot of our troopers work in the metropolitan area, and we've got troopers all over the state of Minnesota. Every station is a little bit different. Every station is unique. Our Northeast stations, for instance, Grand Marais and Two Harbors, are staffed with three troopers each, and so our ability to have 24/7 coverage there is different than other parts of the state of Minnesota. You mentioned working with other agencies. We work incredibly collaboratively with every other agency. We wouldn't be successful doing our mission alone. I like to think they think the same when they consider the State Patrol's work, but those relationships are really important, and in Greater Minnesota in particular, I don't think the citizens necessarily care who shows up when they call for help. It's that somebody shows up. And I know that to be the case when another officer is looking for assistance, that those troopers, those deputies, and those local police officers work together every single day on all things related to public safety. When it comes to recruitment, we've always placed incredible importance on recruiting the best people to the State Patrol. That's been part of our history since 1929. That continues. That number of applicants, the pool, ebbs and flows, and we're in a period, as most people have read, where there are fewer applicants than we'd like to see, but we've been more successful than a lot of agencies in our recruitment efforts, and we're continuing to do everything we can to have a strong applicant pool and recruit the best people to the State Patrol.
Representative Driscoll, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Colonel Langer, to that point, kind of another interesting little anecdote. In the neighborhood that I live in, since I've moved to that neighborhood, the police chief in the town that I live in has moved there. A police chief from a neighboring community who saw the office of county sheriff has moved in there. I'm not sure if it's because I live in that neighborhood that I'm getting that or what the issue is. But nonetheless, in conversations with them, they say that they get a number of applicants as well, but they're disappointed with applicant, not specifically the person, but because there are things that are in that individual's background, criminal activity that would preclude them from being a sworn officer in the state of Minnesota or in these different agencies where they might have had other criminal convictions, felony convictions and things, but people are still applying. So I think that the aggregate number looks good. But when you get down to the pool of candidates that you would want to have in the State Patrol or that the other agencies across the state of Minnesota be looking for, many of them get precluded either by post regulation or get precluded because of other hiring criteria that I think most people would want to have as screening criteria for law enforcement. Can you comment about concerns that you might have on pools of candidate the pool of candidates? To select from to help Minnesota to have that comfort and confidence in law enforcement.
Colonel Langer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so I personally take that background phase very seriously. If we hire a state trooper, I feel like I'm the one that's validating that I believe this person is worthy to wear the badge, which is a symbol of the public's trust in our state troopers to do their work. So the background process is incredibly important to us. We go to great lengths to look at everything that the applicants do. Human beings aren't perfect. State troopers aren't perfect, but we're looking for their history and their track record to make sure that we're hiring the best people we can. Should make mention to this committee, if you haven't heard, we have a LEADO program. It's a law enforcement training and opportunity program. We've done that. Well, we have a history back to that type of program that goes back to 1994, but for the past 10 years, we've called it LEADO. That allows us to go out and recruit people with a college degree, a 2- or 4-year degree in any discipline. So that has been a great benefit to us as an organization for a number of reasons, but two big reasons are, number one, we're recruiting people with diverse background to the State Patrol, different career fields, different ethnicities, gender, age, all kinds of diversity that we can attract and make us better as an organization. Number two, it's just a whole different pool of applicants that helps us with our recruitment to maintain the staffing level, as you asked with your first question.
Mr. Chair, I could continue on asking the Colonel questions.
If you have one more question.
I do, and I just want to make a kind of a summation comment on this. And one of the things that I want this committee to understand and the legislature is that there is an academy that the State Patrol puts out, and they look for candidates, and they bring the best of the best, and they go up to Camp Ripley, which is north of my district, and they train. And not everybody makes it to the academy for various reasons. But I do want to call out the work of previous members of the legislature, and Representative Lomer, when she was here, and former Lieutenant Governor Fischbach, then Senator Fischbach, were extremely helpful in getting dedicated money to the academy so it wouldn't have to be appropriated every year in the legislature to be able to build that program in place. And I think we need to continue to support that as members of the legislature. Another thing that members need to keep in mind is that by state law, troopers are required to retire by age 60. That's state law. And so we owe these individuals some help in bridging gaps from time that they're eligible for Medicare and the time that they're done with their work careers and different things to appreciate the service that law enforcement does on behalf of all of us. And Colonel Langer, I appreciate what you do and the members of your agency and the members of all law enforcement agencies here in the state of Minnesota. Because if we can't get up in the morning and count on law enforcement, we become a lawless society, and that's not good for any of us who are trying to raise our families and to care about our daily affairs and business. So thank you to you and your agency, sir.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a couple of quick questions, and this could maybe be for either Colonel Langer or the Deputy Commissioner. Obviously, with the number of miles that are being driven each year, we're replacing our vehicles quite often. I was just inquiring twofold. What is the parameters? When do we start achieving the mileage on a vehicle that it requires replacing? And what line item or budget item do those replacements come out of?
Colonel Langer.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so It again ebbs and flows a bit. The way that we replace our vehicles, there's a motor vehicle title transfer fee on every title transfer in Minnesota, and that is, I think it's $3.75 if memory serves me, but that is collected, and that helps the Department of Public Safety, and our fleet is the largest with our vehicle replacement costs. It depends. We'd like to replace them before we encounter great maintenance costs, or certainly before there's any safety issue. I can tell you right now, the vehicle mileage is about 130,000 miles before we're selling those vehicles at state auction.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Colonel Langer? Okay, great. Thank you, Colonel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes, continue.
So the Office of Traffic Safety, I just hit a button that went the wrong way. There we go. The Office of Traffic Safety has a mission to prevent traffic deaths and serious injuries by changing human behavior in Minnesota through policy development, support, stakeholder engagement, program delivery, leadership, research, and evaluation. So what are they working on? They're working on ensuring that people understand the consequences of their behavior, that they have researchers to determine how to communicate and ensure that teen drivers are safe on the roads, that people are not distracted while driving, while they are using their seatbelts and driving at appropriate speeds at all times, and especially during bad conditions. And through this, so you can see the services that they work on, they do a lot of data collection and providing that information to with other partners, safety partners. They work very closely with the Departments of Transportation and Health in the program towards zero deaths. They receive an appropriation from the general fund. They are predominantly receive federal funds, and they grant those federal funds out to local communities and law enforcement and other partners in these areas with respect to traffic safety.
Deputy Commissioner Hearn,
yep.
Representative Bernardi has a question.
I just wanted to get clarification. So I really like this mission a lot, and you said something about the department collaborates on Towards Zero Death, which is a MnDOT initiative. I'm just wondering, this, like I said, this mission is awesome, and then I look at the service that's provided. Are these driven by funding sources, and that's why there's not a line for work zone safety, there's not a line for pedestrian safety? I'm just wondering how come those important areas have not been translated into actual programming in your department.
Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So first off, I would like to say that the Department of Public Safety is a co-chair with the Department of Transportation on Towards Zero Deaths. And that is a collaboration with the department along with the Department of Health. And if I might, I'd like to call the director of the Office of Traffic Safety, Mike Hansen, to come and talk specifically about the pedestrian questions and bicycle questions that you have had.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner O'Hearn. Welcome, Mr. Hansen. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mike Hansen, and I am privileged to serve as the director for the Department of Public Safety Office of Traffic Safety. And I'm willing to stand for questions.
Any questions for Mr. Hansen?
Okay.
Representative Bernardi.
I think he was brought down to answer my question. So I'm trying to figure out how we can translate the important work of to prevent traffic deaths and serious injuries to the work of keeping pedestrians safe on our roadway, to keep people who bike on our roadway, and to keep our workers who are working in work zones on our roadway safe, and wondering how can it get the same level of attention as these other issues are. Is it funding? Is it choices? Is it TZD solves all the problems? That's what I want to ask.
Director Hansen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bernardi, it's all of the above, I guess, would be the best way to answer that. And it's a very timely question because this year we've had already preliminary 7 pedestrian deaths. And as of this morning, we had 24 road deaths in Minnesota since January 1st, compared with 16 at this time last year. And we've seen that significant uptick in the number of vulnerable road users, primarily pedestrians at this time of the year, who have been impacted by that. We are in the process now of writing a request for a grant from NHTSA specifically for the pedestrian programs that we're working with MnDOT and some of our other collaborative partners to try and address the problems that we're seeing with pedestrians out there. When you talk about the work zones also, that's another separate thing that we're also going to work with in MnDOT. I don't know if Colonel Langer has talked about the concept of TIM or traffic incident management, but that's another growing concept that we're trying to bring here to Minnesota to reduce the exposure that those vulnerable road users have when they're either walking on the side of the road, working on the side of the road, biking on the side of the road. We're looking for those strategies that will best protect Minnesotans in all of those activities.
Okay, Bernardi, a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to ask for a follow-up, but I really hope that next year's presentation or the year after that it gets in parity with these other things that DPS is working on, because I think it's super important, and on University Avenue, and it's been more since, but in an 18-month period, 9 deaths and nearly all pedestrians is something that we have to get our arms around, and I would expect the Office of Traffic Safety to be a leader in that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hansen, is there a ranking, I presume there is, but I've never seen it, of how Minnesota fares amongst other states on the toward zero deaths? I mean, I ask this because having driven around in Tennessee about a year ago, they're bragging that they have 900 traffic deaths on the highway each year. So I would imagine we're right up there with the best.
Director Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, representatives, you are correct. Minnesota is seen as a national leader in the field of traffic safety, thanks in part to the Towards Zero Deaths program. I believe the last year that I recall, I've seen the numbers for, which was either 2017, Minnesota was the third safest state in the country. The metric that is used to measure traffic safety for states is fatal crashes per 100 million miles. And in Minnesota, that was 0.067, I believe, as recently as 2017. Other states still trend well over one death per 100 million miles. So Minnesota does stand tall, and we are seeing it. Other states actually come to us and ask us, what are we doing, and how does this Towards Zero Deaths concept work? And we have visited other states and presented on it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. Thank you, Director Hansen. Commissioner O'Hearn.
Thank you, Mr.
Deputy
Chair.
Deputy Commissioner O'Hearn, I've promoted you here. Deputy Commissioner O'Hearn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I'd like to talk about driver and vehicle services. Their mission is to provide fair, accurate, secure, and timely service through the effective service options, accurate collection of data, fraud prevention, efficient collection of state revenue, quality information, and support for staff and business partners. The DVS has a variety of program areas in this division as well. It has the title and registration unit, driver's license issuing, driver's license examination, driver compliance, which is determining when somebody has to have their license revoked for some reason and when can they get it back, such as with the DWI, interstate trucking and registration, auto dealer licensing and inspection, and, of course, the Public Information Center, which we tend to call the PIC. There are over 1.8 million drivers that are licensed in Minnesota. There are about 1.7 million vehicle titles, 6 million vehicle registrations, 1.26 million license plates. The department typically brings in about $1 billion a year in revenue collection. They're a large division. They have almost 500 employees that work in 95 locations around the state. They also work with business partners to include 174 deputy registrars and dealer's license agents. They receive an annual appropriation from a special revenue fund and some from the highway user tax distribution as well. Any questions on DVS?
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. O'Hearn,
I have had a complaint about the Arden Hills Testing Center. I don't know if it's the only one where there's quite an inability to get people, an appointment for their tests. I mean, somehow they just don't have enough testers, and it seems to be kind of ongoing. And just maybe you're hearing that too, but would like to know if there's any breakthrough coming on that.
Mr. Chair, without my even asking, DVS Director Don Olson is here to answer that specific question, if that's acceptable.
Welcome, Ms. Olson, and please state your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Don Olson, and I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services at the Department of Public Safety. Scheduling road tests this past summer has been a challenge for us. Primarily, the challenge has come because of the launch of the new driver's license system that we launched in October. We had several staff that had to be trained to be able to be trainers across the state and provide training to driver's license agents as well as their own staff and to prepare for the new system that was coming. So fall was not our best time for people to be able to get in and scheduled for road exams. However, since the first of the year, the numbers are much more palatable. And generally speaking, people can get in within 2 to 3 weeks. We know that coming up to summer is always busy because we have new drivers and people that are finishing their driver's ed that want to get tested. And so we always have a turnover in staff in the driver examiner position. It's not the easiest position to fill and maintain. So staffing is usually a problem for us. We like to be fully staffed by the start of summer, but things happen and we're not always able to make those positions filled. So we're trying different options. We try different strategies to be able to work around that. But right now, I think we're able to accommodate what comes in for us. But we are trying to prepare for what it would look like this summer if we don't get any additional staffing or if we have any staffing gaps.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Runbeck. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To this point, my granddaughter and her friends, who are all at the stage where they're now, they qualify for a license, have the good fortune to have parents who can drive them down to Mankato because their waits are months. I mean, so this is an ongoing problem, and it's quite long. Literally, they would wait months to be able to take the driver's test, so they go down to Mankato where they're able to be served.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative, I think as DVS Director Olson has indicated, this is an area that the department is looking at very carefully, as the department does in all areas of customer service, whether that be title turnaround, whether that be how fast you get your driver's license, you know, after you apply for it, or how quickly you can take those driver's tests. So the information is tracked actually weekly, and at this point, to determine where are those locations where there are openings. It is true at times that there are openings in nearby places or other places where the times aren't quite as long as some of the busier locations. In addition to staffing issues, at the closed circuit, such as in Arden Hills, the Plymouth and Eagan exam station, those are also limited, quite frankly, by space. You can only have so many testers testing at the same time. And so it is a function of trying to ensure that the schedule, that the staff are there to meet the demand of the needs, and that improvements have been made recently also to scheduling so that individuals seeking to schedule are better able to see if there is a nearby location that might meet their needs as well. That was something that is recent with the new driver system, but being able to track and look at information with respect to scheduling. But the department understands, they hear from frustrated individuals. Many of us are parents too. That have gone through this same experience, and we understand and are working on it.
Thank you. Any other questions on DVS? And members, just again, not everyone was here when I mentioned this at the beginning, DVS is one of the grouping within the Department of Public Safety that does work on MNLARS, and we will be taking a deeper dive into that issue later in the month. We'll also be hearing some bills from time to time as they come up as it relates to this. I know there's always issues here, and you have some staffing and funding needs related to that. I know the legislative auditor is going to be coming out with another report. So I just wanted members to know that you know, this committee will be probably dedicating the better part of a hearing just to look at MNLARS. There's also a legislatively mandated commission that Representative Torkelson and I sit on, and we'll probably be convening that sometime in the next month as well. So MNLARS issues are kind of also under our jurisdiction. So thank you for that. And I think we have one more section here, Office of Pipeline Safety.
We do. The Office of Pipeline Safety's mission is to protect the lives, the property, and environment through the implementation of and program of gas and hazardous liquid pipeline inspections, enforcement, accident and incident investigations, and educations. There are approximately 65,000 miles of pipelines in the state of Minnesota. They receive their funding from special revenue and federal funds. I'll get to some of their programs that you might be more aware of. All right, the Call Before You Dig education program, which provides over 6,000 individuals, contractors, utility company representatives, members of the public. It's an educational program aimed to keep Minnesotans safe while digging for underground utilities like natural gas lines and electric cables. This is make sure that before you plant a tree, right, or something like that, that you call before you dig. They also provide and have over 7,000 hours of inspections, investigations, and training aimed to ensure that those 65,000 miles of pipelines in Minnesota are inspected and safe. And I would like to call, if there are any questions, the chief engineer from the Office of Pipeline Safety, John Wolfram.
There is one question has come up already. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is in regard to the recent tragedy. I think it was in Mexico where people were actually cutting into the pipeline. Do we have many incidents like that in this state? I mean, I can't imagine trying to steal from a pipeline, but.
Is this our entree into Mr. Wolfgram, or?
Good afternoon.
You want to answer that? Please state your name for the record and welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hornstein, members of the committee. My name is John Wolfgram. I'm the chief engineer with the Minnesota Office of Pipeline Safety. And to answer your question, committee member, as far as, you know, incidents like that, you know, typically things we may see would be something like a copper theft. You know, when copper prices come up high, if you have an abandoned home or something like that, you may see occasional, you know, incidents that might occur where, you know, someone's going into a home, stealing copper out of a home, causing an incident. But where people are actually stealing gas, to my knowledge, it hasn't been anything recent, you know, in my time in pipeline safety. We would have that type of occurrence.
Thank you, Representative Mason.
Thank you. I'm familiar with the copper, too. I think at one of our facilities near us, somebody tried that in it. Didn't turn out so well, but actually stealing from a gas just boggles my mind. Thank you.
Do you want to proceed with any additional comments, Mr. Wolfram?
If there might be any questions, I'd be happy to stand for any questions that you might have.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to have a quick question and comment. I appreciated the Department of Public Safety's involvement 4 years ago when we did a fairly comprehensive bill on both rail and pipeline safety questions and issues. And I know that we created a fund for that purpose, I think primarily to fund first responders and other related activities. I just wanted to see if you had any updates on kind of the balance of that fund, where things are at, what was that fund used for? I know it's been sunsetted already, but if you have some thoughts to share on that.
Mr. Chair, the pipeline rail types of training that were all carried out by the Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, they would be best able to answer those questions. I knew that they had gone through and had some various personnel allocated to do some various kind of initial training with both emergency responders in regards to rail safety and pipeline safety. Beyond that, I wouldn't be able to answer any other questions.
Actually, you raise a good point, and I'm glad you did. What is the relationship between the Department of Public Safety and Homeland Security? Because that's a federal agency, but of course they have a state role and responsibility.
Well, the Department of Public Safety has a division of Homeland Security, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and so they do provide training in the pipeline and rail safety area, and we can get, along with the State Fire Marshal's Office, which is another division of the Department of Public Safety, we can get you more specific information with respect to what that funding has been used for, because as you are correct, it did sunset, but that information typically is provided in our overview with respect to the Public Safety Committee.
Thank you. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question goes back to Office of Traffic Safety.
Any questions for any of the previous testifiers would be in order. We have about four more minutes, and so Representative Petersburg is next. Thank you. Proceed, Representative Cagle.
Thank you. So my question is there any instance where there are problem areas that kind of rise up and that you identify when there's a higher number of incidents and then examine that, you know, what's going on in that area? As Representative Bernardi alluded to before, we've had a very high incidence of pedestrian fatalities on a stretch of University Avenue in our up in the North Metro. And it wasn't until we raised the issue with MnDOT that they kind of looked at it and saw that it was, you know, the incidents were very high. And so I'm just wondering if there's a way that, you know, that you guys get that information ahead of time before we have to come and do that.
Director Hanson.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, you're almost asking for like an early warning system. And while we don't have a formal system in place to accomplish exactly that, our researchers are always looking for trends. And as soon as we start to see a trend, then we'll take a deeper dive into the data to see if we can identify a strategy that will allow us to address that. Everything that we do is data-driven. And so if we have a data point that starts to stand out, as the pedestrian issue has this year, and as it started to last year, that has raised it up onto our radar screen to the point where we are going to try and take a look at it and incorporate some of the lessons learned from some of the programs that we've implemented in the past.
President Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how do you work with the other agencies then to ensure that you're not duplicating? I know MnDOT has just recently done a safety audit of that corridor. And so is that something that you're included in when that safety audit happens or when they're looking at that information to make sure that everybody is aware of the situation?
Mr. Chair and members, that's the beauty of the Towards Zero Deaths program that we co-chair with MnDOT and with the Department of Health. When one of these crops up, all of us come together and we form, we will form a work group to take a look at this, and that's kind of where some of those safety audits and things like that will come from.
And the follow-up? Before I call on Representative Petersburg for the last question of the day, I did see a couple of our incredible first responder firefighters take their seats, and I believe it is Firefighters Day on the Hill. I just want to say we appreciate your work so much. You're out on the front lines, and thank you for being here. And you know, we appreciate your presence in the community as well as here in the Capitol. So thank you. Representative Petersburg, our last question of the day.
Thank you.
Goes to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is for pipeline safety, and it kind of reminded me when Representative Mason was talking about gas and other things. A few years ago, I was working on issues related to farm taps. And there are little less than 2,000 of them around the state in which when pipelines, major pipelines, go through agricultural land, the farmers and others were allowed to tap into those. That's why I call farm taps. Unfortunately, with the one call, each utility is responsible for locating their particular gas line or electrical lines and so forth. Because the farm tap was considered an independent utility, and a lot of them aren't registered, it was very difficult for agricultural tilers and others to know where they're at. And as one says, it's very eerie to look behind your tiling machine and all of a sudden seeing gas come up because you cut through one of those farm taps that they didn't know was there. And so we've been working with various companies, Merck being owns most of them. Has the agency been working on any more involvement in either getting those independent utilities to be owned by the major companies or doing something else to help with that type of location? Because a lot of times Minnesota One Call doesn't even know they're there.
Mr. Wolfram.
Mr. Chair, Representative, to answer your question regarding the farm taps themselves, certainly we recall meeting with you a number of years ago kind of talking about that issue where these are looked at as the service line itself as a private utility under
right.
the current one-call law structure. And steps that have been taken to bring more awareness regarding how that utility is looked at, more awareness and education to the agricultural community about the presence of these lines and how to get them located. I know that there has been some differences or some things that you had discussed Minnesota Energy, and I know that they have been looking at how they might incorporate and look at these lines as currently the way that they're structured, they're owned by a transmission company, and then Minnesota Energy would kind of act as a contract operator for those where they carry out certain functions. As far as bringing those into scope of our current regulations, just the way those regulations are set up, this would be looked at as a private facility, and then really looking at educational efforts to get to those people, get them to know that they need to be located.
Well, last question, Rivers.
I think you're absolutely right, because a lot of these were done in which there was no locator wires or anything put with them, and there's actually no information about where they might go through the farm site, and it's very important. And I know that there was some push for PUC to allow for all of these to become part of the actual transmission line or the vendors itself rather than independent, which is really helpful. So anything you could do to help with that would be appreciated. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Petersburg. With that, members, we stand adjourned. Thursday is Aviation Day here. Next Tuesday, we'll start to hear some bills, and those will be posted in the next couple of days. I appreciate all of your questions, and we stand adjourned. Okay.